Greetings, my friends. Well, it is March 4th, and I'm sitting here in the Whitefish office, which is really just kind of a desk in my bedroom at the house. It is a beautiful day outside. It's going to get close to 50 degrees, but they say winter is starting up again tomorrow. But I can tell you, spring seems like it's not that far away. Yesterday, I found my first dead housefly sitting in a windowsill. And then this morning, I saw a spider walking across the floor. So spring must be coming soon. There's some actual animal activity. Actually, birds are flying back too. So I'm seeing more birds, which usually happens here in the first part of March. Today is day 4 of the Iran conflict. I've been getting more phone calls about it, as you might expect. I mean, people are wondering what to do. There has been a pretty balanced response between those who wonder if they should sell versus those who ask about buying. In essence, should I reduce risk or is it time to be opportunistic? One message that we have repeatedly seen from the UBS research team is to expect volatility. That was last year and this year, and don't overreact to headlines. Although I got to admit, this seems like a pretty significant headline, but perhaps this is just a case in point. The market is still only a few percentage points away from its all-time highs, and I believe that the UBS message is correct. It is time to not overreact, and it's a great time to do nothing and wait until we have a little more clarity. Today, oil prices spiked up big again, and that's because the Iranians have claimed that they've blocked the Straits of Hormuz. And if you go online, it kind of is confirmed. Insurance companies don't want the boats going through the strait right now. So for all intents and purposes, the Strait of Hormuz is shut down now, and that's why oil is up pretty big. So, you know, what happens at times like these? It would be a natural question. And our director of equity research, David Lefkowitz, put out a piece yesterday afternoon, actually. And what he did is he illustrated what has happened in the 19 military conflicts that we've seen subsequent to World War I. And, you know, what the returns have been after the first month and what the returns have been after 12 months. Frankly, the most significant drawdown happened when Germany invaded France back in May of 1940, and the markets did pull back 23% in the first 30 days. But surprisingly enough, if you look at all 19 of these military engagements, the average drawdown after 30 days has only been 1%. And actually, after 12 months, the returns have averaged a positive 10%. And they've averaged a positive return something like 78% of the times. So I thought I'd go online and try to get the data. So I went on to Microsoft Copilot and asked how often the market actually advances in any given year. And the result was 3 out of every 4 years the market advanced. And, you know, frankly, that was, data going back a very long time. If you look at the data over different decades, it does kind of change. So, it's pretty close to that 78% number. So based on the data, you know, military conflicts are less market relevant than I would have ever expected. So even at the advent of a war or a conflict, including World War II, which was pretty extreme, the market after 12 months has had positive returns 78% of the time. That actually kind of surprised me. And further on in his research piece, David reconfirmed his belief that the S&P is going to end up at about 7,700 by the end of the year. And that basically, from where we are right now, is a 14% return. Prior to this conflict in Iran, actually, things were a little choppy. The dollar has been dropping, and we all see gold has been rising. The foreign markets and the emerging markets, once again, are outperforming the U.S., and frankly, I hate when that happens. There has been this idea of sell America, the sell America trade. It's taking place, suggesting that the U.S. exceptionalism has ended. It's run its course. Do I believe that? Heck no. I do not believe that at all. The underperformance this year has mostly been in the technology issues. Tech stocks so far this year have seen significant underperformance, mostly from confusion around artificial intelligence, or what they call AI. What is now being referred to as the fourth industrial revolution, and the center of this fourth industrial revolution is the United States. So in my mind, U.S. exceptionalism still exists, but regarding this technology and societal change, there is just a lot of angst. The confusion stems from two extreme narratives. One is that it is a bubble causing huge overvaluations that can never be supported by any revenue stream, a la, Y2K. Or number two, that it is so significant and so transformative that we will all be out of work soon. One commentator on the All In podcast this week made the comment that we have moved from trying to figure out when the revenues could arrive to if the revenues could arrive. Given that, PE ratios or valuations have contracted over this uncertainty over the last few months. So to help us sort out all of the confusion and the cross currents, today we're going to be joined by the UBS Wealth Management Technology Analyst, Kevin Dineen. Kevin is a guy that I am always pestering to keep us invested in what we perceive to be the most productive areas. He is incredibly responsive. He always answers the phone when I call or sends me a text telling he'll call me right back. The guy is just a phenomenal resource, and I think you're really going to enjoy the discussion that we have today. Thank you for being the speaker on this March episode of Newport Legacy Insights, Kevin. I truly appreciate you being such a tremendous resource to me and actually our whole team. And, before we jump right into it, I got to correct something I just said. Things are changing so quickly. I commented on the Strait of Hormuz being shut down. And just in the last couple of minutes, Trump has come out and suggested that the U.S. Navy will escort ships through the strait. The U.S. government potentially could offer insurance for these ships as well. So in essence, we are seeing the market stabilize a little bit right now, and we're seeing the price of oil come down a little bit right now. So it's amazing how fast things can change. I've only been on this microphone here for about 7 minutes, and all of a sudden, we have a change. But Kevin, again, thank you so much for being here. Why don't we just get right at it? And from an investment standpoint, we're seeing two conflicting narratives regarding the AI issue and our future, in essence. One narrative there's been a focus over the last month or so that AI will basically be the nuclear job killer, creating a jobless economy and economic death spiral, this creating a job market similar to the 1930s. There's been a few articles flying around in the last few weeks talking about that, and I've got friends and neighbors kind of upset about that. The other narrative suggests that we are currently seeing an AI bubble with a peak in CapEx investments today that will likely never be justifiable based on any possible revenue generation in the future. In essence, kind of a redo of the Y2K period. These two narratives seem to be in direct conflict. Both are negative outcomes, pushing values down. It's amazing how Americans seem to like the scary movie concept. But is this fear justified, and how do you reconcile the conflict that we're seeing?
Yeah, Mark, first off, thanks for having me on. It's great to be back with you. And I agree. You know, I think there are a lot of disconnects in the current narrative that we see in the market. On one hand, as you point out, a lot of people say AI is going to kill employment, and not just kill employment, but drive a lot of software companies out of business. If that's true, then I would argue the world is structurally short of computing power and that CapEx would need to go higher. At the same time, though, as you point out, there's concern that we're at peak CapEx and there's concerns about the return on investment, and companies that are in the so-called AI compute complex, they continue to trade lower as their PE multiples compress despite rising earnings estimate. And it's as if the market's pricing in a significant cut to their revenues, which is something we, quite frankly, don't see happening based on data that we hear coming out of the supply chain. And I think it comes down to, you know, markets love, I should say market participants love binary outcomes because they're simple. They're simple arguments to make, but I think the reality is actually pretty complex. And the reality is that technology causes disruption. It always has. It always will. It makes productive people more productive, and that productivity drives growth, and that growth creates opportunities. So tying these things together, you know, I think AI, could it cause some job displacements? I'm sure it will. Will it also create new industries and new opportunities and new categories of labor that we don't really think about? I'm sure it will. But I think we will also, by the same token, have some companies that don't make it to the other side of the AI transition, just as we had some companies that didn't make it to the other side of the internet transition. And we're going to have some companies that come out of this more well-positioned than they did going into it, and we're going to have new companies emerge. So, you know, my baseline view is AI will impact every single industry in the global economy. For the time being, meaning the next couple of years, I think it's really going to be primarily focused on cost savings. I think the biggest challenge to AI adoption is not the technology itself. I think it's change management. I think it's businesses understanding the complexities of AI, the security issues of AI, having the right processes in place. I think it's also employees getting more comfortable with it, you know, actually investing their own time to learn how to use those tools. So I think people will have to adapt. But the good news is the U.S. labor force is very flexible. In fact, it's the most flexible labor force in the global economy. So that makes me, you know, fairly optimistic. And then I think on the return on investment conversation or question, I think that's actually kind of a complicated issue. And I'd say two things on it. First off, I think just the way that we discuss and the way that the market talks about return on investment, it's like we all forgot accounting 101. We compare CapEx revenues that are going to be capitalized and depreciated over a long amount of time. In other words, spending that's not just for this year, but for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And we're comparing it to revenues for this year. That's a fundamental violation of the matching principle, which I learned in freshman year accounting. I think the other thing to think about is maybe an analogy. And I think this is remarkably similar to building out railroads in the 1800s. And I've used this analogy with you in the past, so I apologize if I'm repeating myself. But, you know, if it was the 1880s or whatever it was when railroads were being built and you and I decided to build a rail line from New York to Albany, kind of midway upstate in New York, we would put a lot of CapEx in the ground. We'd lay the track, we'd buy the cars. We'd have a lot more CapEx than we would revenue that year. But if we see that project being successful, if we see the passenger loadings going up, if we see cargo being taken off of barges and horse-drawn carriages and put on our railroad, are we going to wait to build Albany to Buffalo and Buffalo to Chicago and Chicago to San Francisco? No, I think we're going to run out. We're going to get as much financing as we can. We're going to make those investments to try to get ahead of the market. So I think there's some of that going on also. And I think, you know, basically at the end of the day, I think the largest spenders in the AI complex, I think they're spending because they see the opportunity as orders of magnitude larger than anything they've ever addressed before. You know, because simply put, AI is based on technology, but the addressable market for AI is not the technology budget, which is about 5% of GDP. It's the labor market,
yeah,
which is 55% of GDP. I think there's a lot of cross currents, but I think you can tie them out if you take a practical clear-eyed view.
Yeah. You know, if you're a aging Luddite like me, things are changing so fast that it's hard to really keep up with where we are. Let's face it, most of, you know, my clients are going to be somewhat reflective of me. Can you give me a sense or give us a sense of how things have changed just in the last year and where things could potentially be in another year or so at this point?
I don't think you're a Luddite, Mark, but I'm hoping you're not calling me from like an old Motorola StarTAC or
my flip phone.
Yeah. Yeah. So look, I think there's been a lot of progress in the last couple of years, and I think it's almost hard to appreciate. So I would say large language models generally, they've gotten more capable. We see that in benchmark scores on a variety of different tests. They've gotten more reliable. You know, a year ago, we used to be able to make fun of AI hallucinations, which is sort of what a five-year-old would call a wrong answer. You know, we dressed up wrong answers and we gave it a euphemistic name, called it hallucinations. And they've also become more context aware. I think, you know, another change has been, this is a little bit technical, but when you go into a large language model like OpenAI or, I'm sorry, ChatGPT or Anthropic, what you're interacting with is called the context window. That's the length of the question that you can put in. Maybe you're uploading files for it to look at or for it to draw some information out of. That context window has gotten a lot larger over the past year. And the upshot of that means that you can put in more complex questions. You can put in more complex directions. You can put in more data, you know, as I mentioned, files. So it's like the input has gotten much more robust. And in some ways, this is, if you took freshman year programming, the first thing you learn is garbage in, garbage out. So the larger context window means you can put a lot more high quality data into your prompt. And that should help you get a much more high quality answer.
You know,
and I think you've seen that.
Yeah, actually, I was doing a continuing ed class for UBS. They assign X amount of these continuing ed classes every quarter. And this one I was doing yesterday was on using AI and how to get it to work to your benefit. It basically talked about how to formulate questions. And it was really kind of interesting. I mean, there's an acronym on how you set up the questions. And it's so specific. It says, as an example, do you want your response to sound more like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times? I was like, you got to be kidding.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting. One thing that has created a little bit of angst is the fact that we don't seem to see much job formation taking place. Are you seeing much in the way of a reduction in force in some of the technology companies? I assume they'd be the first adapters if the lack of job formation is based on AI.
Yeah, look, I would say not yet, but we're watching it. And I think what's hard to really disentangle is cyclical versus structural unemployment. You know, we did see some slower hiring in technology in, you know, areas like programming. I think it was last year. You know, it's a little bit hard because it was certainly a slowdown in like the software industry. And I would argue not for every company, but for certain publicly traded companies, like business was slowing before we ever started talking about AI as a threat. Like we see that. We saw revenue growth that was still growing, but growing at a slower rate. We saw the leading indicators for revenue growth, you know, the KPIs, key performance indicators, KPIs, things like bookings, billings, deferred revenue, RPO, CPR, the whole alphabet soup of all these KPIs. You know, for some companies, they're already slowing. And I think it's a function of some of these companies had sort of maxed out their market opportunity. Maybe the market had gotten saturated. But, you know, I would say that we're not seeing it yet. I did see that Challenger put out some data that said 6% of jobs lost in 2025 were attributed by the employers to AI. And that's actually kind of a meaningful number.
And yeah, no, it's more significant than I would have thought. Yeah.
There's a couple of companies that, you know, made big announcements about ripping out software and getting rid of people with AI. And in one case, it just didn't happen. And in the other case, it seems to me that like they're hiding behind AI to cover up the fact, or to, you know, sort of obscure the fact that they had massively overhired. That they had massively overhired, and when you benchmark them against direct competitors, they were clearly, like, on a revenue per employee basis, they were clearly overstaffed.
You know, I heard a comment recently that during the pandemic, you had so many employees that were working, let's say they were getting paid for a full-time job, but they're working the equivalent of like 2 days a week. And now that there's this mandate to return to the office, all these companies are finding out that they have way too much labor. And if these people actually are working 5 days a week, they don't need to hire anybody. They need to actually do a reduction in force. So, I mean, that, and I think there's some truth to that. But
I think a lot of this is going to be like water finding its level. I think there's some truth to what you're saying, that companies are recalibrating.
Let's get back to the AI thing. If, you know, if you're a white collar worker, and for those on the call that are gainfully employed, and if you basically feel that your management position could be threatened, what would you advise people to do to remain relevant?
I think about this a lot personally, and because it's what I cover. And AI, it's a wave, it's coming. And I think everybody's got to decide if they're going to surf or get swamped. And I think it's now is when we have to each individually invest time to figure out how to harness AI, how to integrate it into our workflow. And, you know, I think it's sort of like when you hire a junior employee to make an investment in time, they tend to be more inefficient at the outset. You tend to have to iterate a lot. You tend to have to give a lot of feedback. They tend to slow you down before they become additive to your effort. You know, it's the same thing with AI. I'll give you, you know, some examples. I'm an analyst. I have financial models. I'm using AI tools to build financial models. Not so much the forecasting side, but like the actual getting all the data together, getting data cleaned up, getting it formatted, you know, historical income statement, balance sheet, cash flow, operating segments, all that stuff. That takes a lot of time. It's important. It's not super high value, but it needs to get done. I use a tool, one of the big tools, and I have to sort of go back and say, well, you gave me the annual income statement, but you only gave me the quarterly income statement going back 5 years. You have to go fill in the rest. Or why did you combine all these line items? I want the data exactly as it's presented. And it's funny because it'll actually argue with me and say, that's a lot of data. I'm not sure I can do that.
Unless you pay more.
It's funny too, because I feel like I'm actually understanding sort of with every attempt more of the best way to work with the tool. Meaning, instead of giving a very long detailed instruction, I give it a very short sentence of exactly what I want it to do and where I want it to get the data from. And it really is like having a first year associate.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm getting better at it and it's driving productivity for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So UBS just recently, in a report this last week, that AI will cause job losses this year, and that the Fed actually is going to respond to the labor force contraction with two interest rate cuts. I was really surprised to see that they actually are attributing a contraction in labor based on AI. And they said the cuts would happen even if the economy is strong. And I assume for the sake of your job, if that's UBS's position, to a certain extent, you must agree with that, right?
I'm going to tell you, Mark, I'm not sure. Quite honestly, I'm not familiar with the piece you're referencing. You know, I tend to be more bottom up at the, you know, the company level or thinking about my sector. I would say this. I'll go back to what I said at the outset. Technology has always been about productivity. Productivity has been about growth. Growth creates opportunities. Corporations will hire productive people. I think at the end of the day, corporations are in a war for talent. I think if a company sees, you know, the ability to accelerate its growth by hiring and maintaining or headhunting people who are just super adept at using AI in their daily process, I think those people are going to keep and get jobs. I got to say, I didn't see the piece. There's going to be dislocations, but at the end of the day, companies will hire productive people, because what every company in the world wants to do is one thing, grow.
And I agree with you.
And you grow through productivity.
I agree 100%. And maybe the comment was used to justify their interest rate hopes of two more cuts. But yeah, it just surprised me that they were suggesting that it could happen that fast. But on the investment side, and I know that you can't talk on a podcast about any specific issues. It's, you know, we can't do that. But maybe you could look at it from an index perspective. And how does the overall tech sector look from a historic valuation basis, given the fact that we have seen what seems like some pretty significant drawdowns in some of these areas? Well, I guess in the software area. But overall, are tech issues, by and large, as a group, overvalued? Or, you know, what do you think?
I'm hesitant to make big statements about the group at large, because I do think it comes down to looking at companies at the individual basis. But, you know, having said that, let's just deal with some numbers. So if we look at the IT sector, broadly speaking, the sector's trading at just under 25 times forward earnings. That's a little bit rich to the 10-year average, which I think is kind of interesting, given that we've seen, one, like such strong earnings per share revisions, better than most of the market. The technology sector is a very high return on equity, return on invested capital. So not only is it growing earnings quickly, it's growing earnings very, very efficiently, right? Because that's one way that you can think about ROIC. It's a measure of the efficiency of the profitability of the business. And when we compare the current valuation relative to the market, we're trading at a 10% premium to the S&P 500. That's about the lowest it's been since pre-pandemic. So just on this metric alone, I'd say the market, the sector looks a little bit inexpensive, but the devil's in the details. And as you mentioned, we can't go into single stocks, but we can talk about industry groups. So software, as you mentioned, that group is just outright cheap. It's trading at 22 times forward earnings. That compares to the 10-year average of about 26. It's trading in line with the S&P 500, so essentially the same multiple. I think you have better structural growth. Now, there's all the debates about AI that you touched on, but this is the lowest relative valuation that we've seen in at least 10 years. So that group looks pretty interesting. We put a note out earlier in the week walking through the software industry and how we see things shaking out, who we think is relatively immune versus who we think is at risk, and we actually made some ratings adjustments based on that. On semis, you know, it's a little bit of a different picture. That group is trading a little bit rich. It's 23 times. It's well off the high valuation. Like, we did see richer valuations. Some of that was, I think, the market anticipating a recovery in earnings, but we're trading around 24 times earnings. That compares to the 10-year average that was just below 20, so a little bit rich versus the historic average. Relative to the market, you know, it's about a 10% premium. That's a little bit above where we've been. I would say there, though, like, there's a wide range of semiconductor companies and growth profiles. So I think that one, you know, it's cyclical versus secular, AI versus non-AI. I think we have to be really careful about sort of putting a big broad label on semis.
Yeah, but in general, lastly, if we look at, semis have always been considered to be a cyclical product. And just like some of these other industrials that are in the business of either creating electricity or creating electrical connectivity or data centers, et cetera, all of those are trading above their average because the expectation is, you know, all this stuff's going to be built out over a period of about 5 years. So I can see why the chip sector would be a little richer right at the moment than it has been, say, 10 years ago, because you've got this runway ahead of you.
Yeah, that's true. And what you have to be careful about is some of the more cyclical semis are already contemplating a lot of growth for a few years. So you have to ask yourself, like, how much better can it get?
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. I think we can't paint semis with, like, one broad brush. And then, you know, if we wrap it up on hardware, you know, that group's a little expensive. It's trading 26 times, 26 and a half times forward earnings. Historically, on average, that group traded at 20 times. So we're rich versus history. I could argue that the growth profile is probably structurally lower because changes in the smartphone market. And relative to the S&P 500, you're trading at about a 25% premium. That looks pretty rich. Historically, on average, this group traded at a mid-single digit premium versus the S&P 500.
Yeah. Well, we're getting on in time here. So, you know, and given that they refer to AI as the fourth industrial revolution, what do you think could be the biggest surprise for all of us going forward in terms of how we live our lives, how we work? You know, what kind of changes might we expect? What would be the biggest surprise to you, or what do you think is coming for us?
Yeah. So I think we're going to be shocked over the next 2 years about the performance gains in large language models. I think it's because human beings are not, we're not wired to understand exponential growth. And right now, we continue to see pretty much, you know, exponential improvements or step function improvements in the performance of these large language models. And we're still at a point where the scaling laws seem to work, meaning the more compute we throw into a model, the better the outcome. The more time we spend training the model, the better the outcome. The more time we spend fine-tuning the model, the better the outcome. The more data we throw into the model, the better the outcome. We're just not hardwired to understand that. And I think that's going to be a surprise. I think we're going to be surprised that over in 2 years, just how integrated this will be as part of our daily lives. I mean, I think education, healthcare, finance, I think it's going to be just pervasive. And, you know, I always say, you know, if you think back to, what was it, 2007, when smartphones were just sort of kicking off, and you wouldn't have really looked at a Palm Treo, which Palm is a company that doesn't exist anymore, mm-hmm. and say like, wow, you know, there's going to be like 8 billion people on the planet walking around with a smartphone, and there will be a whole cottage industry of chiropractors who work on people's necks because we stare at these things so long, right? So, you know, I do think technology just tends to penetrate deeper than we expect. And look, I think to that point, I would just wrap it up by saying, I think we're going to be shocked by how integrated into our personal and professional lives AI will be.
I would think that, you know, things like, you know, the robotics or the self-driving cars, or, you know, they've been talking about self-driving for the last 5-6 years that is just around the corner. I would think with AI that something like that could just, could come really fast. I mean, yeah. Much faster than we expect.
I was at the UBS Technology Conference in Phoenix in December, and I got into a self-driving Waymo for the first time. Mm-hmm. And it was a novelty for about 3 minutes. And then I was like, wow, this is great. Like, this is totally normal. I actually felt more comfortable with essentially a robot driver. Not that there was any humanoid form in the car, but like, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this is not about the technology. It's about the change management.
Yeah, and just think about this. You talk about productivity. You probably didn't even tip the thing.
You're right. And you know, it's funny. I think it did ask, like, when you get the follow-up, it did ask if I wanted to leave a tip, which is...
Oh, my God, that drives me nuts. I see, you know, that, do you want to leave a tip? You go online and buy something online, and it says, do you want to add a tip? It's like, what, are you crazy? Do I want to add a tip? Yeah, buying something online? Go figure. Oh, well.
Here's a tip. Go ask somebody else.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, I really, really appreciate all your time. And I appreciate every time I have some concern or question or whatever, and I reach out to you. I mean, you get back to me instantly. I mean, you are the hardest working guy I know, and I really appreciate you.
That's kind of you, Mark. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, I thank you. So, everybody, this wraps up our March episode of Newport Legacy Insights. This is Mark Foster and Kevin Dineen, and thank you so much for listening in. Have a great day. Bye-bye now.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.